Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast.
Hello, Slackers, and welcome to the Slacker Podcast. I hope you're good. I hope you're well. I hope that this winter of discontent is treating you as well as it possibly can. I know it's been a little bit difficult for everybody to sort of jump through this lockdown too. I guess it's different wherever you're listening to. Like, I mean, I'm in the south of England in Brighton at the minute, and like we're firmly squarely in the house pretty much. And it's different for different locations. But I wish you well. I wish you all the best. And I'm doing my best to create as much content to take your minds off it as I possibly can. I've been using podcasts a lot recently. I've been doing a lot of running, and it's definitely been really helpful for me. I'm also working on another project at the moment that won't become clear mainly till the very beginning of next year. It's a brand new thing. I don't really want to talk too much about it, but it'll mean me tripling, quadrupling the amount of content that will be coming out per week. It means I'm just going to be busy as fuck, like scarily amount. But I'm really, really excited about it. But listen, I'll let you know more about that when I possibly can. I've also started up like a little Discord chat for fans of the Slacker Podcast, for fans of my chill radio show. Basically, the Chill the Beasts have taken to Discord. It's only been up for a week, and there's about 250 people on it, and they're suggesting all sorts of albums. They're starting communal playlists together. They're helping each other out with different various bits and pieces, and it's a really natural environment for everybody to hang out and talk about music and talk about themselves and just communicate in this very sort of isolating world. So I will put a link to the Discord group. If you've never been on Discord before, it's really handy. It's just like an open chat room. It's like a chat room from the 90s, but everybody's on it. Yes, I will link up to that. Also, thank you to the Patreons. Big shout out to Brandon Lee Harris, who I recently did a private Slacker Podcast with, which you can get on patreon.com/Slacker Podcast. There's no the in it. But yeah, big ups to everybody who's been donating to it and supporting their favorite content. Much love to you guys. And where are we this week with podcasts? I know we took a break a couple of weeks ago, and we've been absolutely hammering them out. I kind of needed that break, to be honest. Like, it was getting a little bit much. I think I'd gone completely weekly since the start of the year, so it's nice to have that week off. The last couple of podcasts that we've done, if you haven't heard them, Action Bronson was last week, Matt Berninger, the lead singer from The National, Kurt Vile, Jake Bugg, Idols, Daniel Avery, Jarvis Cocker, Haim, Leanne LaHavas, Jaden Smith, Bob Geldof, Sleaford Mods, KSI, Phineas, Johnny Borrell, Phoebe Bridgers, Run the Jewels. Yeah, I mean, they're all up there, and they are there for you to enjoy and share if you like. It's been absolutely months as well since I've said, you know, like and share or subscribe or rate and review or whatever. But yeah, if you do like the podcast, and you're like, right, well, I don't have, I'm not giving you any of my damn money. You're not getting into my pockets. But if you do enjoy it and you want to show some sort of support for it, like go and give it 5 stars on whatever podcast app it is you listen to it. That stuff definitely does help, you know. Okay, right. This week it is my pleasure to introduce Tim Minchin, Australian. That would have been a great start to the podcast. Hey, it's the American Tim Minchin. He is the Australian raconteur. He's a comedian. He's a writer. He's a singer. He's a poet. He's just one of these sickeningly talented people who is just very, very good at a lot of different things. And he is just an incredible human being. I had one of my sort of deeper chats with Tim on this podcast. We talked about everything from music to humanism and everything in between. So I think you're going to enjoy this one. I definitely enjoyed editing it anyway. This is the Slacker Podcast with Tim Minchin in 3, 2, 1. Joining us on the Slacker Podcast today, we've got Tim Minchin. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm all right. Yeah, I'm in Australia. It's 5 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon. I should be having a drink.
I was good. Yeah.
I found myself drinkless.
Well, it's 10 o'clock in the morning on Thursday. I'm Irish. I should be having a drink.
You should be a couple down by now.
Yeah, exactly. You should have a couple of Frost Monsters. That's what my friend used to call them. My Australian friend
Frost
used to
go, Monsters?
Do you want a Frost Monster?
Frost Monster. I think it would be a good idea, but I've got a little bit of press at about 8 o'clock tonight, so potentially it could get really messy and ill-advised. So it's probably quite good that I found myself drinkless on this one.
Do you not find that like your tolerance to alcohol has to go up when you're in media circumstances? Because those chat shows don't, like I've heard before on the chat shows, they ply you full of booze, right?
Yeah, I suppose. It's been a while since I did that sort of circuit, but I definitely, living in Australia now and trying to promote this album in America and England, and of course I can't go there, so it's all in this kind of styly. You've got to be careful because you do, I mean, I tend to be pretty loose-lipped anyway. I'm not one of these controlled people who have a message and just say the message. I'll talk about anything, you know. But if I've had a couple of drinks, I do have to be careful that I don't just go blah 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 and say something I regret.
Yeah,
Slack as an asshole.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just that's fact. That's not even like that's you can't.
It's boring.
It's just
that's been
said. That's just fact. But like, I think I've been on both sides of it. Like, I released a book last year and did lots of interviews and stuff around that, and I don't like being on the other side of it. I like asking the questions because I'm like you. I think I'll give a bit too much away sometimes, and then I'm walking out of the place going, why the fuck did I say that?
I know. Mine's like a compulsive sort of honesty. Like, I've been doing it for so long that it's now kind of my thing.
Yeah.
And so to become more media savvy and more quotable and less talkative would actually sort of damage my brand or whatever. So now, like, talking too much and being very honest is my vibe. So I've sort of got myself in trouble, or I've set myself free or something.
This is the bed that you've made, and you just got to lie in it now, and that's how it goes.
It's my bed and I'll shag in it.
So the start of the podcast, we always play a demo, an early demo from the artist in mention, and we have a demo of yours here, which is called Airport Demo. Was Airport the name of the track, or was like, did you record it in an airport, or what's the story?
The track's called Airport Piano, and it's coming out tomorrow, which when this goes to air is probably in the past somewhere. And the opening line is, I wrote this song on an airport piano. But yeah, I do all my demos on Logic, and I most of my demos sound like shitty versions of the end product, as opposed to like hacking it out on a ukulele under a tree somewhere. but yeah, the song's called Airport Piano.
Right, let's hear it.
A dude at the subway, and anxiously digs through his cabin bag, smiles when his wallet appears. He pays for his 6-inch, then forgets that his bag is unzipped, so the contents of it is disgorged, and a jar of Viagra starts rolling away. Women in four-wheel drive Porsches always look miserable. I don't know why they're so sad. Maybe it's the calories they should have had. Filling them up with regret.
That was Airport Demo, a demo from Tim Minchin. What was like the date on that? Like, was that like a recent one? When did you write that?
Yeah, it's pretty recent. I mean, I sort of wanted to give you something from this record, and I wrote that a couple of years ago, or not even 18 months ago. But like lots of songs, its origins are a scribbled down lyric 5 years ago or something. I think the hook line in the chorus is the women in SUV Porsches always look miserable was definitely a line I wrote down when I was living in Hollywood. And the kind of opening line, I wrote this song on an airport piano, is something I scribbled down when I walked past an airport piano at some point and thought I have time, I should sit down. And I didn't, of course, but I wrote a song as if I did. And then, you know, some years later, I went, oh, maybe those two things are the same song and I can kind of make all those ideas fit.
Do you have like a sort of a jigsaw puzzle kind of like lyrics floating about, like written down places, like notepads on your phone, like on random bits of laptop?
Yeah, every now and then it's scribbled down, but mostly I just plug it into, you know, I either send myself an email so I don't forget, or just put it in my notes.
There's something ridiculously unsexy about that, isn't there? Like, I do the same thing when I'm like, I like email myself like, oh, I want to make this dinner, or I've got an idea for something that I want to do.
Yeah.
Like,
dear Philip.
Yeah.
You should make this lovely supper. Love, Philip. See you there.
Yours sincerely, Historic Philip.
Past me.
Yeah, I don't know. I just like, I kind of want somebody just to reply someday if I ever ask that question again, and just be like, oh, and I have a quill.
I scratch it into my forearm with a stick.
I have a duck leather book and a quill, and that's what I write it all in. But I remember years ago, Eminem had a notepad and he lost his shit because he lost his notepad. He was on a flight and left the notepad behind, and he said his whole album was in there, and you're like, you're probably worth like tens of millions, hundreds of millions of pounds. You can't kind of just leave random notepads lying behind. Have you ever lost any music before?
Not for many years. I mean, not that I remember. I feel like I've definitely lost ideas before I started. So the two ways I remind myself of ideas, one is just type in lyric ideas into notes, and the other is I use voice memo on my phone and play little phrases into it or sing little phrases into it. And I'm pretty sure some of them have gone missing, but I don't even remember what they were. You have this vague sense of an idea that you liked in the middle of the night or some, you know, when you were fiddling around one day. And I do think about the songs I never wrote, the phrases that came into your head that might have been good. But I also think if you have a good idea, it'll probably stick. If you have a good melodic idea, it's likely to stick. If you've forgotten it, probably wasn't all that crash hot anyway. But I really think you'd be pretty stupid to write all your lyrics in a notepad on a plane and that be your only copy. I think Kitson lost his jokes in progress once.
Wow.
That'd be a befuddling read for whoever picked it up.
Yeah, exactly. Because like nobody ever understands your notes like you do. Like I do a radio program once a week on Radio 1, and I come in with nothing and I just sort of like shoot from the hip or whatever. But like I have a piece of paper that will have like Abraham Lincoln drawn in a corner and some notes of things that I have to say and a time, whatever time I have to hit the last. If you looked at it, it would look like something that was like scrawled in shit on the side.
Serious psychological problems wrote on a toilet wall. Yeah, I don't. I my notes tend to not be legible. I mean, I know what they say, but when I'm writing them down, but I actually. As you say, it's unromantic. And I've had many notebooks over the years that, especially when I'm in note sessions with other people, like when we're writing Groundhog Day or we're collaborating, that's when I use paper because you don't want a screen. A screen is a barrier to the chat. So I scribble things down on paper then. But mostly the writing things down on a set, like if I have an idea for a song, I open a Word document, write the hook line, and then give the Word document that title and put it in a file because that goes, okay, you've got a blank piece of paper that you need to fill from that idea. So it's not even like lots of ideas in a list. It's a whole Word document for one idea. And they all sit there in my songs in progress file. And although that's nerdy as hell and super unsexy, it really suits my brain.
There's something about that like level of creativity, the before and the during, that are so different. I think like, When I tried to sit down to like write something like creative, I'll have an idea in my head. I'm like going to go and sit down. This is what I want to write. And then when I sort of look at it after I finished, it's like the opposite way. And I'm like, going, where the fuck did that come from? Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's and without exception, all those tropes you see on the internet, you know, the artist's journey is this is a brilliant idea. This is a terrible idea. Everything I've ever done sucks. This is a brilliant idea. You know, that arc you go on, it completely applies. Every song I write, for whether it's for theatre or movies or my record or comedy or whatever, I initially think it's probably pretty cool. Then I have to push my way through it, like just make myself keep writing it, even though somewhere quite early on I went, oh, this is crap. I have to push through that and just write all this stuff down. I think this is crap, this is crap, this is crap, this is a write-off. And then at some point I'll walk away and come back and go, oh, look what I did. That's quite good, actually.
Do you need the sort of acceptance of other people? Like, do you need somebody else to, like, I know I do a little bit. Like, I need somebody else to go, that's actually all right. Or, like, it helps. Like, I don't need it, but it helps to have somebody sort of help with the creative.
Yeah, I used to play stuff to my wife, Sarah. And now I don't so much anymore because she's unable to pretend she likes something if she doesn't. And her taste is not really my taste anyway. Like, she loves everything I do in that she loves me and she thinks I'm a nice chap and I do my best. But, you know, when I first play a song, she doesn't necessarily hear what I'm hearing in it. It's incredibly gratifying when you send a demo off, in the case of my record, for example, to my producer or some of the guys I'm playing with, and they like it. It really is a huge relief. But I reckon, I don't know what you think, but there's this weird thing where once you send it, you kind of have clarity on it anyway.
Yeah.
Even if the person hasn't listened to it, the act of sending it makes your brain go to the thought of them listening it, and the thought of them listening to it gives you clarity on it, like gives you some objectivity. So by the time they come back with their feedback, you already know what it was. You know, you're always like, oh, well, no, she'll like that because of this, and she might not think, you know, like it's quite weird. Just the act of sending it out to the world clarifies your thoughts on it and gets you out of this solipsistic, like, oh, suddenly is an object in the world that you can be more objective about.
That's like, well, with music, you don't get that opportunity that you do with comedy, and that you can like go and like tell a story 10 times and refine it, and then the 11th time that you've told it, or the 100th time you've told it, you've really like managed to scrape away all of the fat, and you've got this really lean, great joke. Whereas music, when it's out there, it's out there. You don't really change it after the fact, do you?
Well, it's interesting because this is my first studio album. I've been writing songs for 35 years.
Yeah, that blew my mind.
Made a record. Yeah,
I thought you had one.
Yeah, obviously I put out all these live DVDs and I played with orchestras and I'm, you know, I'm probably the only Grammy nominated artist on the planet who at 45 had never put a record out. But I guess I put out the Matilda cast recording, but you know, that's obviously not my record. I think the difference is because so much of my material got worked up in a comedy on the comedy circuit in theatres, my songs that I've been playing for years, like Prejudice and If I Didn't Have You and Rock and Roll Nerd and all those silly songs, they constantly evolved and evolved. But unlike comedy where it gets, you hone it and it gets shorter and shorter and sharper, these songs just grew and grew and grew until like Dark Side, which started at 3.5 minutes. I think when I played it on my Albert Hall show with the Heritage Orchestra, it goes for 10 minutes.
Is it because the silence can like really add to the drama of the joke,
actually,
right?
No, although that is absolutely the case, isn't it? When you're doing a bit of stand-up, you don't take into account that you've got these beats and then the laugh and it all gets longer. Definitely with my comedy songs, leaving space is something that comes later. But mostly it's just that my concerts have always been just to having fun with music is as important as having fun with words. So my Cheese song is like a rhapsody in 5 movements. It really is. And I play with amazing players and we have solos and it's like going to a gig, you know, it's like a Grateful Dead gig, but stupider.
I would imagine like if you could get up on stage and play piano all night and play with the band and stuff like that, right? And that would be fine. And that's you playing music. But would you be able to get up on stage and know that there's no other like musical instrument that you can grab or play or anything? Can you just get up and just talk straight for like an hour?
I can and have, but I haven't done an hour. I don't think I'd have problem doing an hour. But I don't see stand up as my mode.
Yeah,
I got okay at it. But about the time I got okay at it, I decided I wasn't that interested in it. I mean, I'm totally interested in it and hugely admiring of the people who are brilliant at it. And I certainly knew I would never get to Stuart Lee or Kitson or, you know. But I just decided that I didn't want to get distracted by the competitive sport of stand-up. You know, don't you reckon? Uh-huh. In Britain especially, it's a competitive sport and it's super judgmental. And some of the best comics always disappoint me when they start panning lesser comics. I'm like, oh, come on, like you're too good for that. And I mean, not disappoint me sounds very judgmental. I'm always like, oh, really? We're doing that? And I decided that especially with the orchestra show, that to have an orchestra and be in arenas and try and create a spectacle and then go, and here's my 5 minutes. It's like, I didn't want it to be that. I want it to be like a theatre show that has funny bits and moves in and out. And so I got less obsessed by the punchlines and more into just making sure the whole thing was just really entertaining is what I wanted. And, of course, to make people cry at the end with a lovely ballad that takes them by surprise and all those, you know, like cabaret things that comedians would rather die than be seen to be sincere.
So it was a pretty natural sort of evolution then, really, sort of once you were getting more into the musical side of things, that like going down the musical theater route, which is something that you like studied and you know, like it wasn't something you sort of just stepped upon, is it? Like I was looking at your YouTube and I was like, how many letters is that guy gonna have next to his name?
Well, most of the letters next to my name are fake. They're like honorary degrees and shit, and don't know where you saw them next to my name, but yeah, all those degrees are not real. But I didn't really study musical theatre, but that's the thing about, especially in Britain, people go, oh, that comedian's doing other stuff now, and it's like, well, no, that other stuff guy briefly did comedy. You know, I was writing music for theatre. My first score for youth theatre was when I was 17, and I was acting and doing Shakespeare in the Park, and I played in jazz bands and wedding bands and rock bands and original bands, and I was a musical director for cabaret acts, and I did all this stuff, and then it all sort of coalesced into this show that was really cabaret, but I called it comedy, and suddenly I was a comedy guy, and bless you mob over there, I got to come there and you guys embraced the hell out of me, and it was just amazing. But only 3 years into my comedy career, Matilda came along. So really, comedy is the thing I got known for, but all I've ever wanted to do is do everything, is like go, oh, I'll try this now. I never had a desire to become the most famous comedian I could. In fact, I very sort of clearly got quite well known and just stopped.
Well, there was that sort of time when you were doing a lot of different things and people weren't able to pigeonhole you, and that was a drawback for your career. Like when you were sending stuff to
in the early days.
Yeah, and in the very early days, like sending stuff to record labels or getting the right booking agents and basically like trying to attract the industry. You were kind of in the middle of the Venn diagram of many different things, which scared the shit out of the people.
Well, I don't think they believed it. Yeah, and that's true. And I, for a little while, thought, well, I better like brand myself. So at one point when I lived in Melbourne, I cut my hair off and called myself Timothy Minchin and went and got an acting agent. And for a while I was like, my acting self was called Timothy and my music self was called Tim. And I had a like comedy show and a serious band. And I was trying to be what I thought that area of the industry wanted me to be. And eventually the absolute opposite is the thing that worked. I went, I'm going to put a show together that just shows off everything. So early on in my comedy career, I was doing like quirky characters and poems and then playing some jazz and then doing a bit of a monologue. And it's like super chaotic. And really that's what became my comedy show, was just me going, actually, fuck yous, I'm going to get up on stage and show off. I'm just going to show you everything I can do, because actually what's unusual about me is I can do a few different things, and I need to make a virtue of that instead of trying to separate them all.
Well, I think that's more power to you for doing that, because you can't move on and become like the next exciting thing hasn't happened yet, and it scares the shit out of people because it doesn't fit into the pre-molded paradigms of this is comedy, this is music, this is poetry, this is vaudeville, this is cabaret, this is whatever.
Yeah.
And that scares the shit out of people, because they don't know how to market it, which means they don't know how to make money from it.
That's exactly right. And that's the lesson I eventually learned in Hollywood, trying to make a different film, you know, like they're like, we don't know what this is. And I'm like, you don't need to, it's going to be wicked. And they're like, too scary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
But that's it. Again, like the time that you had in LA, was, you write about it in this new album, leaving LA, there was I want to read this comment, because the comment like had me pissing myself laughing. Where is it? I don't normally go through the comments. It's not actually, like, I can't remember the last time I actually did an interview and I brought a comment up from YouTube.
That's the scariest thing in the world.
It said, leaving LA, YouTube comment says, for context, if anyone's interested or didn't know already, which is in brackets, Tim has to be largely involved with the production of an animated musical film called Larkins that started production in 2013. It was going to star the likes of Hugh Jackman and Margot Robbie. He spent a lot of time and hard work on it to the point where he and his family moved to LA. So when production was abruptly cancelled in 2017, the song speaks for itself.
Thank you very much, commenter, for your filling in the history.
I was like, I don't even need to write a question for this. I'm just going to read it out verbatim.
Yeah, totally.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's pretty correct. Yeah, I spent 4 years making an animated film for my sins and got shut down. So Leaving LA is not... Well, Leaving LA tries to be a song about this very tempting metaphor of the Hollywood sign being this very famous but frankly two-dimensional and not very special thing, and how that acts as an analogy for the city in general, which is very famous but frankly quite two-dimensional and not very special. However, the song hopefully also reflects my incredible fondness for the city. I consider that song a breakup song. And like all breakups, what you do is you try and think of all the things you didn't like about that person. You know, when you're trying to talk to your mates about a breakup, you go, oh, yeah, she was this and that and the other. And even as you're saying it, you're going, but also she was this and that. But you're trying to focus on the bad things to make yourself feel better. And that's what Leaving LA, even though he's listing all this stuff that sounds like he's contemptuous of it, the melancholic sort of reflection of it makes you go, oh, he's really fond of that place and he's trying to make himself feel better.
And there must be the feeling of like not closing the chapter properly on it, because like, no, you don't want to leave somewhere with the job that you came over to finish not finished, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There must be that.
Yeah, I hate that. My personality does not suit that at all.
Yeah, because it leaves an open book, and I'm like that as well. I totally get that. Like, where you want to draw a line under something so you can start something else, and like
that's right.
The idea doesn't permeate into something else.
Sometimes I wonder about my little movie, me and the co-director and the writer and the 100 other people who spent years working on it. Our little film, our little $100 million animated musical that never was. Sometimes I wonder, I was so down about the waste of time and the loss of work and the loss of friendships, really. Mm. Not that I had to lose the friendships, but we were a community and the thing we were doing got taken away from us. And I was sad about all of that. But I sometimes wonder what if it came out and it was a massive critical flop and popular flop? Would that have been worse? Like, is it better that I get to go, it was going to be amazing and those Hollywood fools shut it down, but if they'd let it come out, it would have won Oscars, you know, and I can have that narrative and hold it to my heart and soothe myself. Whereas if it came out and everyone hated it, there'd be no, I didn't do a good job.
Oh my god, I'm finished in this town.
I'm never gonna work in this town again.
How far along was it, and really, if it is that far along and they don't want to put it out, like, I don't know what the legalities are of it, like, but can you not own it after a while?
It's a big old boring discussion, but other animation studios tried to pick it up and Universal Pictures made it financially non-viable, kind of deliberately, so that they didn't look like idiots if it was a success. Yeah.
Oh,
it's proper nasty. It's not nasty, it's just Hollywood, it's just business. They're like, we're gonna shut this down. It was 3/4 of the way finished, really, in time, half finished in content. $52 million or $48 million already spent on it.
Jesus Christ.
And they used that amount of money as a write-off, you know, against the purchase of the studio, as a kind of whatever. And they said to me, we just didn't know, we didn't think it was going to make money. And I went, well, you don't really know, because you're suits and you know nothing about animation. And or what you mean is it didn't look like anything else that had made money, but neither did Shrek, you know.
Yeah.
And in fact, Disney thought Frozen was going to be a flop until 6 months to go, and they audience tested that freaking song, you know. So they didn't know. They knew damn well they didn't know, but they decided to write it off, and then they made sure that no one else, it couldn't be worth anyone else's while financially to continue to make it, because they would look like idiots if Oh, actually, it's a bit more complicated than that. And I don't want to slander anyone.
Okay.
But yeah, it's all that shit. It's
yeah,
all that
exactly. Boring. If there's somebody that you, like, you don't want to go after, it's Hollywood execs because...
you don't want Comcast, who own Universal, who own DreamWorks, suing you. Comcast is basically like Jesus smiting you. That would be really bad.
They have better lawyers than I do. My mom is pretty hot up in the box there, but like...
yeah, is she? That even your mom wouldn't be able to stand up to Comcast. I think their lawyers have an entire building just there on the Highway 5 or whatever it is.
What was like the thing that you loved about Hollywood? What was like, what would bring you back there?
Well, I don't think I'd go back there because I very much love working and I don't know. Look, I could well go back there, but I even the people I love over there have a sort of, it's not a place for people who go, I just want to make good stuff. I just want to put good ideas into the world, you know?
Aye.
And that's me, really. I'm just like that nerd. And I like having done well. But I just mostly, I want to put good stuff into the world. I think a lot about the morals of it and all that stuff. Mm. So it's probably not, and I know that's really righteous and stuff, but that's just my small town something. But I loved living in the Hollywood Hills. It happens that my wife and my kids just like, we found a really good school and we made really nice friends and I kind of learned to snowboard and went up to Mammoth and snowboarded and went hiking through Griffith Park near where we lived. And
did you have like a celebrity friend and a celebrity friend with children that hung about with your children? I always just imagine that that's what happens when you go to Hollywood.
I mean, we knew some names you'd know, but we early on went to quite a few of those parties and just decided it wasn't for us.
I thought it was like Curb Your Enthusiasm. Like, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm where like you've got like Larry David going over to Ted's house and they're all just going, they're talking about what they're having for dinner and you're just like, God, what is that life? Where like they've all got hundreds of millions in the bank and they just sit around just going, might go for coffee, might buy a jumper today. That's the big thing.
Oh man, I know so many of those people and they're good people. They're no different from anyone. They're just, the only difference is they can't really go out and it's awful. And really you don't want it, but there's no point me sitting on a podcast going, you don't want it. Because if you think you want it, you're going to go for it. And if you get it, you're going to sort of feel a bit sad, but that's right. You'll be rich and sad and that's good.
You're a very recognizable person. Where do you get harangued the most? And like, is it Britain? Is it Australia? Is it the US?
In this suburb here in Perth, West Australia, by the beach. And it's not really haranguing. It's that everyone knows someone who knows my mum or everyone knows my family.
Yeah.
So the fact that I'm a bit of a celeb means, but not only that, but they've all got a good in. So, you know, when people recognize you on the street, mostly people either go, oh, that's that guy off telly, I hate him, he's ugly, or, oh, that's that guy off telly, I really like him, oh, I'd like to say hello, but I don't want to interrupt him in his day, you know? And then there's the group who go, oh, I want to talk to him, what am I going to say? And that group of people in Perth, they all know what they're going to say, because it's like, I used to work at the hardware with your cousin, and then my daughter went to Scotch, and I know you, you know, like that. So this is where I can't move around much. And after that, London, really.
I've been that person, the person who goes up to people. I've done it a couple of times, I reckon, right? Once I was like, I was in a bar in Madrid and Kevin Bridges was sitting at the bar. And I was like, I fucking love Kevin Bridges. He's one of the funniest comedians about. I'm going to let him be. I'm a bit pissed. And the last thing he doesn't need is me going up. And although, like, Kevin Bridges was sitting in the pub chatting away to everybody holding court, so I think he probably was enjoying himself. But on the flip side of that, being as dead on and sound as I was there, I was equally, probably, if not worse, a ball bag to John Lithgow.
Oh, really? Oh, he's lovely.
My band was playing, like, when I was a kid, was playing in Dublin. And we were driving past and I had like a bass amp, a big, huge Ashdown bass amp on my knee. And as we were driving past, I started stuttering. I was like, it's your man. It's your man. So I just wound
the, old mate.
Yeah, so I just wound the window down and I didn't know what to say as we were driving past. I just put my head out the window and I was like, hi, Third Rock. And he turned around and I was like, fuck you. Yeah, I'm not proud of that. I'm not proud of that.
It was like a fan moment. That
yeah,
right
I was like, I love you. Yeah, I don't know what to say. I'm just going to say,
yeah,
fuck
the
you.
Worst thing is that there's lots of different versions of it. And I'm very lucky. I think my level of recognizability is probably quite nice. I get, especially in Australia with my sort of activism-y stuff, I get a lot of people coming up, saying, when you wrote that song, my cousin who had been abused by priests like talked about it for the first time and all that stuff, that really lovely stuff. But the worst, that well, there's two, the drunk ones who like think that they have to be really funny and that they're going to show you how funny they are, and the probably worst is the people who just go, I'm going to be super cool, and they'll be super cool, and you're like, don't come up to me and be super cool. Like, if you want to be super cool, don't come up to me. Don't come up to me and be super cool. Like, come up and go, hi, Tim, I'm Stephen. I really enjoyed this. And, you know, like,
yeah,
like, if you want to pay me a compliment, pay me a compliment. You don't have to. You can hate me, but don't be cool. Like, yeah. Fuck cool.
What's up,
I've too? Never been cool to anyone in my life. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, must be shit. Must be shit having to put up with, they go, oh, it must be shit having people come up and talk to you in the street. I won't bug you. It's just like, all that's unnecessary. If you've come up, say something nice.
Yeah.
I'll have a photo and I'll be really genuinely grateful. And then that'll be it. That'll be lovely.
You mentioned the sort of like, the sort of social action and stuff that you've done before, like in the activism, sorry. How does it feel in 2020 when you're like a creator and stuff? Is it hard for that, like stuff like, I don't know, like the pandemic, anti-vaxxers, fucking BLM, God, like where do we stop with do you know what I mean? Like, is it hard to create without that sifting into your consciousness?
It's a really big, good question, I guess. I'm not sure how interesting I am as a respondent to it, but I have made a decision that for my own mental health and kind of for what I think the world needs now, I mean, there's absolute huge validity, obviously, and necessity in the Black Lives Matter movement and in all the people standing up for justice as they see it for their identity and their political group. I think the world's in a very, very tough place. And I made my career on polemic and on eviscerating what I saw as poorly formed ideas and philosophies, right? So good, I think that was a fine thing to do. But then the, you know, Twitter came along and the whole world was just people being polemical, being eviscerating. And I have sort of over the last couple of years decided that I'm going to try and firstly disengage a little bit, not because I don't think ignorance is great. It's just that I was getting very unhappy and that unhappiness is not good for my children and stuff with all the anger, and I was addicted to Twitter and the news and all that. So I pulled back from that. And through this year, all I've tried to do is put out work that some people might like and try to use my privileged position of still being able to work and not being broke, because so many of my fellow artists and production people have no work. I've just tried to keep generating work for my audience, but also generating a bit of employment where I can for session musos or, you know, camera crews to make music videos and trying to be positive while the ship lists.
It's
just trying to make stuff and to talk a bit about the slightly bigger things. This album is really about, you know, about time and love and death, and, you know, it's a bit of a bigger record philosophically, and I feel like that's right for me at this time in history.
Is it because this is your debut album and it's coming out, and it's not a comedy album, and it's like, you know, you very much yourself laid sort of, for want of a better term, yeah, laid bare. I was about to say laid raw.
what does that mean? I did Slacker podcast, and he laid me raw.
There's my soundbite for Instagram.
But
like, does it feel different putting it out to putting anything else out? Because I don't know what the psychological, what's going on in your head putting this out. Like, how do you feel?
What were you thinking, Timothy? You had a perfectly good career with the silly. Look, as I said earlier, I'm just a singer-songwriter with lots of opinions, and I've always written songs, and I've just taken a long time to get a record made because I got busy writing theatre and doing cabaret shows. But it's not a big... For fans, for like people who have really got into my work, this is utterly unsurprising, because actually the people who really get into my work, they come for Prejudice and Cont and Fuck I Love Boobs, but they stay for Beauty is a Harlot and White Wine in the Sun and Not Perfect. And sorry, I'm talking very indulgently about my own stuff, but my fans stick around because when the ha-ha of the funny wordplay is gone, there's all this other material that I've always played, even in my comedy shows. When I toured the UK last year, a third or half of the songs are there to make you feel and think and even shed a tear. And some of them are incredibly small, sincere moments. And I think what I'm good at is getting the balance right, is being able to take people in all these directions. You know, it sounds so... sort of trite to describe it, but I think that's what my shows are.
I always hate that word, dramedy.
Yeah,
I've never.
Me too. Yeah.
I'd but never heard that word before until about two years ago.
I banned it from the writers' room. So the other thing that's happened in the last year is I was heavily involved in writing and acting in this TV show Upright, which I really like, and. You know, it's gone really well in the UK and in Australia, and it's just out in America, and it's all around the world. And it's funny, but you should watch it and get back to me, because I think it will undo you, even you. it's really hits people in the heart bones. And so this album, for people who are actually kind of following what I do, is just a very natural thing. And in terms of being laid raw or laid bare, I've always written like this. I've always written slightly awkwardly, honestly, and that sometimes has been used for comic intent. And this in this album, there's still heaps of quirky lyrics and heaps of sort of me style turns of phrase and overuse of syllables and stuff. But it's just a lot more, it's something to listen to in your lounge room. The reason I never put my comedy songs into a studio album is because I think comedy songs in a studio album is the shittest thing ever. But I want people to be able to put a record on that I made. So I sort of made it a slightly more contemplative thing, I guess.
Who is your guru when it comes to wordplay? Like, who do you look at? Like, because like wordplay, you know, it works brilliantly across all mediums, like who are your sort of comedic wordplay artists, like your sort of lyricists, like who do you enjoy?
I guess
all the old British comedians seem to be like that seems to be half the jokes, like the two Ronnies, like Ross Abbott, stuff like that.
Yeah, that's like playing with games, and obviously Tom Lehrer, who was this incredible American pianist comic. But really for me, it's because I was brought up in a very sort of theatery. I went to a lot of theatre, and so the play with word, I mean, the bands I love, like the Kinks, all the British bands, the Kinks and Queen and the Stones and the Beatles, they all had this, I mean, you think about the Beatles, they were just having a laugh a lot of the time, a lot of their songs, but especially all their banter when they're on tour and all their movies they made and all their, they're just four boys having a proper laugh. And half of the Kink stuff these days would be called, the Americans would want to call them novelty songs, like Dedicated Follower of Fashion or
Yeah, I suppose, but like that, but I don't see them as novelty songs. And like
there shouldn't be a word, that shouldn't even be a phrase. I mean, you're just writing songs, and there's lots of different ways to write songs.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. Like, I mean, like thinking of the quote unquote novelty song, they're normally more one hit wonders than anything else. Like,
and it's like someone who's learnt three chords on a ukulele, and the fact that it is a song is funny. But my stuff's never been like that. My stuff's always been musically as ostentatious as it is thematically. I mean, my stuff's, calling it a novelty song is, is a little diminishing because they're more complicated than pop songs, not less.
You know? Do you ever push it too far, like when you're writing? Do you ever go, wow, that's actually, like, I've gone too theatrical on this. This is like.
Well, I think Freddie Mercury never said he'd gone too far.
I mean, he used to have a piano behind his head on his bed so he could play his piano while he was asleep or like while he was lying down.
Did he really? Yeah. Is that a true story?
Oh, well, any Freddie Mercury stories true? Probably.
No, that doesn't matter anymore. I sometimes with this record, with a part together, like the opening track on the record, Summer Romance, is, I mean, it's pretty bombastic. It hits a chorus and just gets huge, and there's 20 strings and four French horns and it just goes boosh, and it sort of belongs in an arena. But I'll never, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't expect this record to go as well as my comedy career did, because who the hell gets two bites at two different cherries like that? And I don't mind. But it's written because I've played in those spaces, my brain expands into those big, you know, epic rock songs. I also remember I was brought up on U2 and these huge
stadium rock and stadium pump and stuff like that, of course.
And I loved it. And I was brought up on Freddie and you know, Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple, and talk about ostentation. There is no shame, and it's glorious. And remember, my favorite musical was Jesus Christ Superstar. Like, I have no
It can't go far enough. I love that. Kind of moving off the music just really quickly before we finish.
Yeah.
I noticed that you're like a part of the British, you can tell me if I'm wrong here, I often am, the British Humanist Association.
Oh yeah, when I was there I was trying to support them as much as I could, and actually I was discussing being president for a year, but I didn't think I'd be able to dedicate as much time as I would want.
I got married in a humanist ceremony.
Great. And did they do it for you?
Yeah, they.
DHL?
No, we did it in Ireland. It was the Irish version. And I remember when we did it, like, I was a little bit like, because I come from like a Catholic background, so does my missus, but neither of us are really anyway religious at all. And I just remember thinking, going, wow, this is going to be really weird for my family, because there's a lot of people who are quite religious. And it was was the nicest ceremony. It was all around the concept of love. There was no hellfire and brimstone. It was a really lovely, warm feeling of a ceremony. Like, everybody felt good. And even I was looking through the room and was talking to my like aunties and people who might be a bit more religious afterwards. They totally got it. I mean, there was one part
I'm so thrilled to hear that. That's really great.
Yeah. So like, I never really thought I was like sort of like religious or spiritual or had any sort of a group to tie myself to, but I did notice that you had the humanist thing, and I was like, I've never talked to anybody about that before, and I thought I'd ask you as somebody who has been involved with it to sort of explain it to somebody who might be listening now.
Well, I think, by the way, they're called Humanist UK now. They had a bit of a brand change, but they on one of the main fights they've had, I mean, they do all sorts of things, including putting gut pressure on our government to put pressure on foreign governments to try and help prisoners of conscience. Like there are in Pakistan or in the Middle East, there's still blasphemy laws that can get you killed. I mean, do get people killed, including very close associates of Humanist UK who have died in recent years, either by rebels bombing their university office or by their own governments. They go to prison and then, oops, sorry, yeah, they died in prison of something. We didn't mean it. And this happens a lot. So that they're really politically active. But one that the other big fights they have at the moment is trying to stop Britain relying so much on religious schools. Humanist UK and I and many people don't believe schools should ever be allowed to discriminate on the basis of religion. Education should actually be separate from religion, especially state education. And Britain's got it all mixed in together. And the other thing they've done is tried to make it legal to have a humanist wedding without then having to, you might know about this, but until recently, or maybe still in some parts of the UK, you still need to get some church sign-off to say you're married. And the British humanists, or the Humanist UK, have been trying to make it that the sort of wedding you had is legally binding as well as...
Yeah, no, ours wasn't. Like, we had to go, because we were getting married in the Republic of Ireland, and we had to like go over like 2 months beforehand, sign papers, and like go into.
And were they church, they Catholic papers, they churchy papers, or just government papers?
No, I think it was government papers. I don't think it was churchy.
I'm not clear on that stuff. But isn't it so crazy that in 2020, if you want to have a ceremony, talking about the importance of love, and it can even be really spiritual. You can have amazing celebrants who talk about the importance of ritual and gathering and all those things, but just disconnected from the idea that Jesus was magic and that some government thinks that's less true, that that's less real as a ceremony to commit yourself to someone. It's just bonkers that you have to go, oh no, I believe Jesus was magic, now can I get married?
Yeah, but it's great. There's more Catholics and there's more Protestants, there's more Christians and there is humanists, so like they vote. So like
that's right,
that seems to be the
and
reason.
Actually, I'm not sure that's true anymore in Britain. Most people are like certainly not, most people don't go to church. A small percentage of people are practicing, like 20 something.
Yeah, I don't know anybody my age. We all live in a bubble. Do you know what I mean?
It's hard to know what everyone else is doing.
Like what everybody else is doing.
Good data on this stuff that Humanist UK gather. They're a good mob. If you wanted to get involved in a sort of gentle but long-term important community, they're a good mob. They're really, Andrew Copson, who's their main man, is a very bright, very kind man.
We came on to talk about your career and your album, and we've ended up giving a big up to the Humanist UK.
What am I selling?
Yeah, I'll be walking out of this going, I don't remember what it was I was had to buy, but I'm becoming a humanist.
Yeah, that 14 quid you were gonna spend on my special edition vinyl. Donate it to Humanist UK. No, that's not the right message.
Tim, listen, thank you for giving me your time, and good luck with the record coming out and the 5,000 different projects that I'm sure will happen in the meantime between me and you talking again.
Thanks so much. It's really nice to chat. You're lovely.
Thanks.
It's nice to find out people are lovely.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.